Hello, welcome to the reading of the Arizona Republic for Tuesday, August 12th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is going to be the first hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic. And in the first hour, we read the headlines from the front page of the Arizona Republic. Today's headlines: Trump sending troops into nation's capital. Inquiry of Mesa Rangers closes, and Israel steps up bombing in Gaza City. But we're going to begin with the article, Trump sending troops into nation's capital. This was written for the USA Today out of Washington. There are four authors of the article. They all work together on it. Joy Garrison, Tom Vandenbroek, Sybil May Zosterman, and Josh Meyer. President Donald Trump said he will deploy 800 National Guard troops to Washington and take federal control of the city's police department as part of an aggressive federal effort to crack down on crime in the nation's capital. On August 11th, from the White House briefing room, as he was flanked by Attorney General Pam Bondi and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, quote, "I'm announcing a historic action to rescue our nation's capital from crime, bloodshed, bedlam, squalor, and worse. This is Liberation Day in D.C., and we're going to take our capital back." Trump signed two executive orders earlier in the day. One invoked Section 740 of the Washington, D.C.'s Home Rule Act to allow the Trump administration to take control of the Metropolitan Police Department. Separately, he signed a presidential memorandum directing Hegseth to deploy National Guard troops in Washington and authorizing him to coordinate with governors to utilize their state's National Guards as well. Hegseth said the D.C. National Guard was mobilized that morning at Trump's direction and will be led by Secretary of the Army Daniel Driscoll. Hegseth said, quote, "You will see them flowing into the streets of Washington in the coming weeks," unquote. He added that the Pentagon is also prepared to bring in additional National Guard units and other specialized units if needed. He then went on and said, quote, "This is nothing new for DOD," unquote. He pointed to Trump's deployment of 10,000 military troops at the U.S.-Mexico border to crack down on illegal immigration. The District of Columbia is a federal enclave under jurisdiction of the federal government. The District of Columbia Home Rule Act of 1973 gave the city local governance, including an elected mayor and city council. Trump, on August 11th, declared a public safety emergency in Washington, announcing that Bondi would take command of the Metropolitan Police Department, with new DEA Administrator Terry Cole serving as interim federal commissioner, citing Section 740 of the Home Rule Act, which allows the president to direct the D.C. mayor to deploy local police for federal purposes during emergencies. Trump seemed to suggest he could later pursue federal intervention to combat crimes in places like Chicago and Los Angeles. Quote, "We're not going to lose our cities over this," unquote, Trump said as he railed against what he called rising crime rates. He went on and said, quote, "And this will go further. We're starting very strongly with D.C., and we're going to clean it up real quick, very quickly," unquote. Trump said he will make the appropriate notifications to Congress and Washington Mayor Muriel Bowser about the moves. A spokesman for Bowser declined to comment ahead of Trump's news conference. Later, on August 11th, during a press conference, Bowser described Trump's federal crackdown as unsettling and unprecedented, while also indicating that she will cooperate with federal authorities. On August 10th, Trump posted on social media that the homeless in D.C., quote, "have to move out immediately," unquote, and at the August 11th press conference said his administration had already begun removing people from parks, underpasses, and other public spaces. He did not explain how the removals would be carried out or where the unhoused would be relocated, only stating that they would no longer be allowed to turn the capital into a wasteland for the world to see. Trump first ordered an increased law enforcement presence on August 8th, resulting in the deployment of 450 officers from 18 agencies, including the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Secret Service, to high-traffic areas and other hotspots over the weekend. Trump's actions followed the high-profile assault of a staffer from Trump's Department of Government Efficiency, 19-year-old Edward Corsatine, that occurred in the early morning hours of August 3rd during an attempted carjacking. The White House pointed to several other examples of violent crime in Washington this year, including the May 21st fatal shooting of two Israeli embassy staffers outside a downtown museum. The suspect is from Chicago. Despite Trump's claims of rising crime and violence in Washington, the Justice Department announced in January that total violent crime for 2024 was down 35% from the year before. In fact, crime in the Capitol, quote, is the lowest it has been in over 30 years, unquote, according to data collected by the Metropolitan Police Department, included in a January 3rd statement by the Washington, D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office. Then U.S. Attorney Matthew Graves, who was an appointee of former President Joe Biden, credited the declines to a, quote, focus on the drivers of violence, those gangs or crews of people who are dealing drugs, protecting turf, committing carjackings and other robberies, all well armed, unquote. During an August 10th appearance on MSNBC's The Weekend, Bowser pushed back at Trump's claims of rising crime in Washington. The mayor said, quote, we are not experiencing a crime spike, unquote. Bowser expressed concern about sending the National Guard into the Capitol, noting that Guard troops are not meant to enforce local laws. She said, quote, I'm concerned about them not being used efficiently, and I just think that's not the most efficient use of our Guard. But that's the president's call about how to deploy the Guard, unquote. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois called the president's press conference political theater and an attempt to distract Americans. Durbin said during a press event for the Texas State House Democrats who are boycotting a Trump-backed push to redraw congressional districts, quote, his idea of federalizing the police force of D.C. ignores the reality. They are making dramatic progress in reducing violent crime in D.C., so it is a typical move by this president to create chaos and uncertainty and to draw the attention from other issues like Jeffrey Epstein and his papers. And that was the article, Trump Sending Troops into Nation's Capital. Our second article from the front page of the Arizona Republic is entitled, Inquiry of Mesa Rangers Closes. This was written by Maritza Dominguez for the Arizona Republic. No criminal charges will be filed against any member of a rogue group of park rangers who called themselves the Goon Squad after a nearly four-month-long criminal investigation conducted by Mesa Police. Two prosecutor offices reviewed recommendations for two different charges, and neither thought the evidence presented would lead to a conviction. Mesa investigators have closed their probe, which launched on April 11th, into allegations of criminal activity and wrongdoing, including using racial slurs, targeting homeless people. This according to police spokesperson John Dreyer. He confirmed this to the Arizona Republic. The investigation began after allegations that a group of park rangers had possession of a stolen firearm, used racial slurs and inappropriate use of force, and shared a Goon Squad patch. The detectives uncovered incidents of rangers targeting homeless individuals, seizing drugs, and coining the phrase gooning to mean dealing with the homeless problem. Detectives reviewed nearly 170 cases involving park rangers, four of which were investigated further for potential criminal misconduct, according to Mesa Police. The department confirmed that one of those four cases was recommended for a misdemeanor assault charge in May. The Mesa City prosecutor turned it down in June. The Maricopa County Attorney's Office reviewed a recommendation for a charge of possession of a stolen firearm. One ranger was arrested on suspicion of that charge, but county prosecutors declined to charge him two separate times. Also, the county attorney's office decided against charging the first time. Police investigators continued to conduct interviews and review evidence and execute search warrants. Police handed over the new evidence for review and possible charging. The county attorney's office declined to change its stance on the recommended charges, which were initially filed back in April, according to Dreyer. In a report dated July 2nd, a Mesa detective wrote, quote, "There are no further leads or evidence to follow up with," unquote. Since Mesa police launched their investigation, at least seven park rangers were placed on leave or resigned, including a second ranger who quit in May. The departures made up half of the 16-person team. The city put the park ranger program under the Mesa Police Department's supervision in April. Mesa also launched a second investigation to look into the personnel misconduct claims uncovered by the criminal investigation. The city's outside counsel took charge. That external investigation into the ranger's unit is nearing its end, and the report should be available in the coming weeks, according to the city spokesperson Anna Pereira. Newly released police supplemental reports provide additional detail on the accusations against the park rangers. The Republic obtained those reports through a public records request. One of the four cases involving rangers that was further reviewed for potential criminal misconduct included an incident on June 17, 2024. A police report described a Mesa officer witnessing a park ranger chasing a homeless man, tackling him, and placing the man in handcuffs. The man sustained injuries when he was tackled, according to the police report. Two park rangers, the man who was handcuffed and a woman who was involved in the altercation, were interviewed by the police officer. His report stated that a woman had called 911, stating that park rangers in the Pioneer Park bathroom were in a fight and that she could hear a loud struggle happening. The two rangers said they had walked into the bathroom and found a man and a woman inside a stall with their pants down and drug paraphernalia on the floor. The rangers said they separated the man and woman and questioned the man, made him empty his pockets, and told him to leave the park, according to the report. The man said a ranger had slammed his head against the wall, according to the police report. The ranger denied to the officer that he had touched or hit the man. The man told the rangers he wasn't leaving the park because his girlfriend was still in the restroom. He got into a verbal argument with the second ranger as he was exiting the restroom, which led to the chase. As the man ran out, he asked a bystander to call the police. The man told police he was homeless. He told the officer the ranger who tackled him choked him and slammed his head on the ground, according to the report. The individual had a small abrasion and swelling on his right eyebrow and a minor abrasion and bleeding on the back of his head, according to the police report. Now, a detective was assigned to review the case in May as part of the police department's investigation into potential criminal misconduct involving park rangers. The detective attempted to locate and interview the man who was tackled, but was unable to find him. The woman, who was the man's girlfriend at the time, was interviewed on May 15th. She told the detective she was tossed by a ranger into a separate stall and told to lift up her bra so the ranger could check if she was hiding drugs. The other ranger was the one who tackled her boyfriend, she said. She told the detective, quote, "It was just uncomfortable that they can do that in a restroom," unquote. The report stated the two rangers were aggressive and used physical control toward the man and woman. The detective said the ranger stated he chased the man for being verbally disruptive and for refusing to leave the park. The detective wrote, quote, "These reasons alone do not give park rangers any authority to detain or arrest," unquote. The ranger had no lawful authority to chase and tackle the man, so the detective recommended a charge. City prosecutors denied the misdemeanor assault charge because at the time, a city ordinance enabled park rangers to eject individuals from the park. The city prosecutor wrote, quote, "That language has since been removed," unquote. Former park ranger Joshua Amato had seized a gun from an unhoused person in January, kept it in his desk drawer, and never reported it to his supervisor, according to Mesa police. A rookie park ranger reported the gun on April 11th. Mesa police arrested Amato on April 22nd on suspicion of possession of the stolen gun. But the Maricopa County Attorney's Office turned down the charges, quote, "due to no reasonable likelihood of conviction," unquote. The city was in the process of firing Amato before he resigned from the position hours before his termination hearing on April 28th. Interviews included in the newly released police reports showed an attempt by Amato and two other rangers to mislead detectives on how he obtained the firearm. Police served search warrants to city offices and for cell phone data. A day after Amato was arrested, one ranger followed up with police on April 23rd. He told police that he remembered that after police confiscated the stolen firearm on April 11th, he saw Amato speaking with Brandon Montez, discussing how they should tell investigators the gun was purchased off the Craigslist website. When the ranger heard Amato and Montez discuss their idea, he told them, quote, "that would be a stupid thing to do," unquote, the police report said. In that same week, the ranger received a phone call from Ranger Charles Miller. The ranger was, quote, "under the impression that C. Miller wanted him to say something specific about the firearm," unquote, but he stated he was going to be honest with police, according to the report. Montez and Miller were placed on administrative leave, pending the city investigation. Now, the weapon came into Amato's possession in January after he found it in a man's backpack. Police interviewed the man on April 26th. The man told police he was homeless and had been sleeping in the bathroom stall at Pioneer Park. Two rangers walked into the bathroom in uniform and another in plain clothing who identified himself as a park ranger supervisor. As he attempted to leave the bathroom, the, quote, "uniformed ranger pushed him back into the stall, causing him to fall back down onto the toilet," unquote, that he told the detectives. Rangers looked through his bag and gave him two options. They could call the police and have him arrested for the drugs they found in the backpack, or let them confiscate it. He let the rangers keep it. The stolen gun was not mentioned by the man during the police interview, according to the report. Days after police launched their criminal investigation, investigators searched the ranger's city office on April 28th. Police found, quote, "four pellet guns that resembled real firearms," unquote. Rangers told police the pellet guns were used for training, and at least one was seized from a transient, according to the report. The police also requested access to cell phone data from Amato, Montez, Miller, and Park Ranger Supervisor Brett Burton, who also was placed on leave. Photos of the stolen tan Canic handgun that was in Amato's possession from January were saved on Miller's phone, as well as the drugs they seized in January from the homeless man in Pioneer Park. Police also found numerous photos of other individuals and various drug seizures. The report stated it was unclear what happened to the drugs or other paraphernalia that were seized by rangers after the December 24th. Investigators were unable to locate any forms documenting seized items. Numerous rangers told investigators that they often used a dumpster located on city property to dispose of transients items. An audio recording pulled from Amato's phone criticized the ranger enforcement changes. According to the report, he stated that, quote, "they came to work knowing that it was time to bash some heads in at Phoenix Pioneer Park," unquote. But now they were, quote, "in maintenance mode," quote, and they couldn't do that anymore. Mesa police had recommended felony theft charges for the firearm in April to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. The Attorney's Office declined the charges, quote, due to no reasonable likelihood of conviction, unquote, it told the Republic in April. But new documents give clarity to that decision. Serena Pocris with the department wrote that the charge was more of a, quote, policy violation than a felony due to lack of intent, unquote. She wrote in a letter to Mesa police that there wasn't, quote, any evidence that Amato ever took the firearm home, claimed it to be his own, or otherwise intended to keep the firearm for himself, unquote. The actions indicated he was, quote, negligent in his duties, unquote, which did not amount to criminal intent. So with the criminal and city investigations, the remaining Mesa Park Rangers have not resumed their usual activities. Nine other park rangers remain active under supervision of the Mesa Police Department. Their current duties include opening and closing selected city parks and amenities. The rangers are undergoing extensive training of the policies, procedures, and code of conduct of the Mesa Police Department and performing other administrative tasks as needed. After the external investigation was completed, there would be an assessment for redeployment into Mesa Parks, she said. And that was the article, Inquiry of Mesa Rangers Closes. Our third article from the front page of the Arizona Republic for Tuesday, August 12th, is more international in scope. Israel steps up bombing in Gaza City. It was written by Nadal Al-Mughabri for the Reuters News Group out of Cairo, Egypt. Palestinians reported the heaviest bombardments in weeks on August 11th in areas east of Gaza City, just hours after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he expected to complete a new expanded offensive against Hamas fairly quickly. An airstrike also killed six journalists, including prominent Al Jazeera correspondent Anas El-Sharif, in a tent at Gaza City's Al-Shifa hospital compound, the deadliest strike against a journalist during an Israeli campaign that has lasted more than 22 months. Witnesses said Israeli tanks and planes pounded Sabra, Zetun, and Shijaya, three eastern suburbs of Gaza City in the north of the territory on August 11th, pushing many families westward from their homes. Some Gaza residents said it was one of the worst nights in weeks, raising fears of military preparations for a deeper offensive into their city, which Hamas says is now sheltering about 1 million people after the displacement of residents from the enclave's northern edges. The Israeli military said its forces fired artillery at Hamas militants in the area. There was no sign on the ground of forces moving deeper into Gaza City as part of the newly approved Israeli offensive, which was not expected to begin in the coming weeks. Amir Salah, who is 25, said, quote, it sounded like the war was restarting. Tanks fired shells at houses, several houses were hit, and the planes carried out what we called fire rings, whereby several missiles landed on some roads in eastern Gaza, unquote. And he told this to Reuters via a chat app. The Israeli military said that its forces on August 10th dismantled a launch site east of Gaza City, which Hamas used to fire rockets toward Israeli communities across the border. Netanyahu on August 10th said he had instructed the Israeli military to speed up its plans for the new offensive. He said, quote, I want to end the war as quickly as possible, and that is why I have instructed the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, to shorten the schedule for seizing control of Gaza City. Netanyahu said the new offensive would focus on Gaza City, which he described as Hamas's capital of terrorism. He also indicated that the coastal area of central Gaza may be next, saying that Hamas militants have been pushed there, too. Now, the new plans have raised alarm abroad, with French President Emmanuel Macron saying on August 11th that they heralded, quote, a disaster of unprecedented gravity and a move towards a never-ending war, unquote. He also proposed an international coalition under a United Nations mandate to stabilize Gaza. Macron said the UN mission would be tasked with securing the Gaza Strip, protecting civilians, and working in support of unspecified Palestinian governments. He said the UN Security Council should work on establishing the mission. He added and said, quote, I have asked my teams to work on that with our partners without delay, unquote. On August 8th, Germany, a key European ally, announced that it would halt exports of military equipment to Israel that could be used in Gaza. Britain and other European allies urged Israel to reconsider its decision to escalate the Gaza military campaign. Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, told Reuters that some countries appeared to be putting pressure on Israel rather than on Hamas, whose deadly attack on Israel on August 7, 2023, started the war. Israel's planned offensive coincides with worsening hunger in Gaza. On August 11th, the territory's health ministry said five more people had died of malnutrition and starvation in Gaza in the past 24 hours. That raised the number of deaths from such causes to 222, including 101 children since the war began. Israel says it has scaled up the entry of aid and commercial goods into Gaza in past weeks. Palestinian and UN officials say the aid is a fraction of what Gaza needs. Medics at Al-Shifa Hospital said the airstrike that killed Al Jazeera's Al-Sharif and four of his colleagues also killed local freelancer Mohammed Al-Khaldi, raising the number of dead journalists from the strike to six. Israel confirmed that it had targeted and killed Al-Sharif, alleging he had headed a Hamas cell and was involved in rocket attacks against Israel. Al Jazeera rejected the claim, and before his death, Al-Sharif had also dismissed Israeli allegations that he had links to Hamas. Hamas, the militant group which has run Gaza since 2007, linked his killing to the new planned offensive. The UN Human Rights Office on August 11th condemned the journalist killings, saying the actions by Israel's military represented, quote, a grave breach of international humanitarian law, unquote. The Hamas-run Gaza Government Media Office said 238 journalists have been killed in almost 2 years of war. The Committee to Protect Journalists said at least 186 journalists have been killed. Hamas-led fighters triggered the war in October 2023 when they stormed into Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking 251 hostages by Israeli tallies. About 50 hostages are still in Gaza, but only around 20 are thought to be alive. More than 61,000 Palestinians have since been killed by Israel's campaign, according to Gaza health officials. Most of Gaza's population has been displaced multiple times, and its residents are facing a humanitarian crisis, with much of the territory reduced to rubble. And that was the third article from the front page of the Arizona Republic, Israel Steps Up Bombing in Gaza City. We are coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, and we have finished with the front page. It's time to turn the page, see if we can find some articles from around the Valiant State. So from the Valiant State section of the paper, this first article is entitled, A Child in This Position Has No Control. This was written by Jose R. Gonzalez for the Arizona Republic. The wide-eyed young girl walked into Jennifer Jones's home in disbelief. "I get a bed?" she asked Jones, her new foster parent. Jones wanted her first foster child to feel fully at home. But home ultimately proved elusive for Zariah Finley Dodd, who was gunned down while pregnant at 16. Some of the women who cared for Zariah told the Arizona Republic that she faced hardships as a foster child, bouncing from home to home before her death in early July, which police say was caused by the man who impregnated her. A teen, who police said was an accomplice to her killing, was also charged weeks after Zariah's body was found in a West Phoenix park. Zariah's life, those who fostered her said, was mired by circumstances that suppressed any chance that the girl had a sound upbringing. Jones, who is 45, said, quote, she had a life of suffering, and it was so unneeded, unquote. Jones suggested perpetual instability may have led to Zariah seeking refuge with the men now accused of taking her life. She said, you have someone who's showing interest that makes promises, and then she gets groomed, unquote. A 5-year-old Zariah and her infant brother were placed with Jones shortly after Pinal County authorities were flagged about her knocking on doors as she pushed the boy in a stroller and asked for food. Little Zariah was thought by authorities to have been the primary caregiver to her brother for the preceding 5 to 7 days after the children's mother seemingly disappeared. Jones said, quote, getting her to stop being a mom took me like 10 months. Recounted how she, even during school, Zariah would want to check in on her baby. Under Jones's care, Zariah knew happiness, taking up horseback riding. But foster care arrangements with Jones would come to an end after 11 months. The Arizona Department of Child Safety, according to Jones, prioritized Zariah's birth family and moved her out of her home. Now, citing confidentiality laws, DCS did not comment on the particulars related to Zariah's foster care. Zariah locked herself in a room when she learned she was being removed from what had been her home for nearly a year, and she jumped out of the moving car when she was being driven away. Her foster mom, Jones, said, quote, she did not want to go, unquote. When Zariah was found with her brother in Pinal County, her father was incarcerated, and her brother's father would soon die, according to her paternal aunt, Canella Bernard, who is 55. The woman and her mother, Zariah's paternal grandmother, tried to make a home for the girl, who was then 6 years old. DCS chose not to separate Zariah from her brother. The agency also failed to provide what Bernard described as necessary medication for the boy. Bernard said about the time the children were placed with her, which was a little more than a month, quote, we had no resources, no help for the brother. He was just placed in our home for us to take care of him, and that was the stipulation. In order to get my niece, we had to take him. Zariah's paternal grandmother tried adopting her, the aunt said, but a family court judge told the girl's biological family that she expressed wanting to remain with her brother and never uttered interest in getting adopted by her grandmother, according to Bernard. So when asked by Bernard and her grandmother why she did not want to permanently stay with her biological family, Zariah would reply that she liked meeting new people, the aunt said. Bernard said, quote, it's almost like she'd gotten accustomed or used to the group homes and the way she was living, and she was okay with that, unquote. Zariah would be placed in as many as 20 homes by the time she became pregnant, according to Richelin Fox, who was a foster mother to Zariah several years ago. Now, Fox, who is 32, said she ran a group home operated by Sunshine Residential Homes, where Zariah once resided. Zariah was in a different group home, a place in Surprise for pregnant girls, Fox said, when during the evening of July 4th she left and was reported missing. Her body was discovered with a gunshot wound to the head in the early hours of the next day at Meraview Park on Osborne Road near 55th Avenue, according to court documents. Jarrell Davis, 36, faces first-degree murder and sexual conduct with a minor, and Jeffrey James Gillett, 18, has also been charged with first-degree murder, according to Phoenix police. James Gillett made, quote, a full confession, unquote, in Zariah's shooting death, court documents said. Davis denied involvement in the girl's death, according to court records. A paternity test determined Zariah was impregnated by Davis, who admitted to having sex with the girl and to picking her up on July 4th from the group home with James Gillett, according to charging documents. A caseworker said Zariah relayed that Davis coerced her into sex in December when she was 15 and that she feared him using his handgun, according to documents. Girls at the group home described James Gillett as Zariah's boyfriend, according to the court records. Zariah asked to visit him on July 4th, and after her request was denied, she asked to go for a walk. According to the documents, she never returned. Now, Fox said that she knew Zariah had a history as a runaway. She reviewed the girl's case file, and when the two met back in 2022, while Fox was Zariah's home manager, Zariah and Fox stayed in touch years after their foster home arrangement ended. The teen was looking forward to being a mom by mid-October and eventually studying law and forensics, Fox said. But now, Fox and Bernard and Jones are left wondering about Zariah's potential if only she had found a long-term home. Bernard still remembers the precocious girl who, at around 8 years of age, was working to launch a business making bracelets. Instead, Zariah spent years running away, possibly in an attempt to assert stability for herself. Jones said, "You start to relax, and then you move again. A child in that situation has no control. And so, if you're running away, you have control." As she faced tumult early in life, Zariah appeared to find peace in the bed that Jones had provided for her. Some weeks after Zariah was moved out of Jones's home, the former foster mother was deep cleaning the girl's room when she came across a note under the bed. Penned in purple was a prayer to Jesus. "Can you help me sleep? I love Zariah." And that was the article, "A Child in This Position Has No Control." Our next article from the Valley and State section: "New Phoenix Police Chief Committed to Transparency." Written by Elena Santa Cruz for the Arizona Republic. Phoenix's first permanent police chief since 2022 has officially stepped into his new role, which he has called a homecoming. Matt Giordano's first day as head of the department was August 11th, and in a video, he said he was committed to leading with integrity, humility, and transparency, and he believes in a department that protects and connects. Giordano began his career in Phoenix. He worked there for 23 years until 2017, when he retired as a commander. He went on to serve as the Executive Chief of Enforcement for the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office under Paul Prenzone, and then as the Executive Director of the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. For months, Phoenix conducted a nationwide search to find a new permanent chief. Giordano was selected in July, about 3 months after the city initially planned to have a new chief. In a statement, he said, quote, "It's a privilege to lead the Phoenix Police Department at such a pivotal time. I am committed to building trust with our community, supporting our officers, and ensuring that we deliver effective, accountable, and compassionate policing." Giordano added that he knows the challenges the department faces, but that there are dedicated people who work there, and they will all work to make Phoenix safer. In June of 2024, the U.S. Department of Justice released a report on the department and the city. It found the department had widespread issues. Officers routinely used excessive force, discriminated against people of color, and violated the rights of protesters and people experiencing homelessness. The Trump administration closed the investigation and rescinded its findings in May. At a community forum in June, Giordano and the other finalists for the chief position said Phoenix police have made positive changes in response to the federal probe and that they would work to build on those improvements within the department. And that was Elena Santa Cruz's article, "New Phoenix Police Chief Committed to Transparency." We're coming up on 40 minutes past the hour, And our next article is entitled, Four Killed in Medical Transport Plane Crash Near Chinle Named, by Julie Mendez for the Arizona Republic. The names of the four people killed in a medical transport plane crash near Chinle, Arizona, in Apache County, have been released. The Albuquerque, New Mexico-based company, CSI Aviation, confirmed the identities of the crew members killed in an emailed statement on August 10th. Amanda Benson, commercial pilot, Camelia Chavez, flight nurse, Nicholas Mancuso, flight paramedic, Jeffrey Tuning, commercial pilot. The aircraft was a Beechcraft King Air B-300 plane, according to the National Transportation Safety Board. It was carrying out air ambulance services for patients near Chinle in northeastern Arizona before the crash on August 5th. No passengers or patients were on board at the time, the company said. CSI Aviation Chief Operating Officer William Collins said, quote, "Our main concern right now is with the families and loved ones of the friends we lost this week. The collective heart of our company is broken. With great sadness, we offer our sincerest condolences to all who are mourning Jeff, Amanda, Cammie, and Nick. We are sharing your grief, praying for your peace and healing, and believing without a doubt that none of these exceptional human beings will be forgotten." Unquote. The Federal Aviation Administration, the NTSB, and local law enforcement were investigating the crash, according to CSI Aviation. The company said it was fully cooperating with the investigation. The company said, quote, "CSI Aviation asked for patience and privacy for the families during this difficult time," unquote. And that was the article, Four Killed in Medical Transport Plane Crash Near Chinle, Named. Our next article, Several Injured in Pennsylvania Steel Plant Explosion, written by Melina Kahn, Jorge L. Ortiz, and Phaedra Tretton for the USA Today. One person was killed, 10 were injured, 1 remained missing, following what Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said were multiple explosions on August 11th at a steel plant in Clairton, Pennsylvania. Allegheny County Emergency Services and the Allegheny County Police confirmed the death at the U.S. Steel Clarion Coke Works plant in a social media statement. Now, Shapiro said on social media, quote, "Injured employees have now been transported to local hospitals to receive care," unquote. Fire crews could be seen battling flames as heavy smoke rose from the facility, according to CBS News and other local news reports. Now, that plant is about 20 miles south of Pittsburgh. A second person was initially reported missing, but they were found and joined the list of those who were injured and transported to a local hospital, according to Victor Joseph, who is Assistant Superintendent of the County Police. U.S. Steel Executive Vice President Scott Bukisu told reporters at an afternoon news conference the plant was stable except for the two structures that were shut down after the 10:50 a.m. explosion. An investigation into the cause of the explosions was beginning amid the search for the remaining missing worker. Bukisu said, quote, "We think we know the general location of that employee, but we're not 100% sure," unquote. Construction worker Zachary Boudet, who was near the steel plant when the explosion happened, told WTAE-TV in Pittsburgh, quote, "It sounded like thunder. It shook my chest. It shook the building. And then we saw the dark smoke rising from the steel mill," unquote. The moment of the explosion, followed by large plumes of smoke shooting high into the air, was captured live in video from the Breathe Project. That's a Pittsburgh-based nonprofit that advocates for improvements to air quality in southwestern Pennsylvania. The Allegheny County Department of Health issued a statement saying that it was actively monitoring the explosion, and residents within 1 mile of the plant were advised, out of an abundance of caution, to remain indoors, close their windows and doors, and set their home cooling units to recirculate. Air quality monitors had not detected levels of toxins above federal standards, according to the department. U.S. Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania said on social media he went to the plant and gathered information from U.S. Steel and the Steelworkers Union. He said, "Air is safe, but remain inside." The Clairton plant is the largest coke manufacturing facility in the country. A coking plant turns coal into coke, which is in turn used to make steel in a blast furnace. Coal is heated without oxygen to temperatures as high as 1,125 degrees Fahrenheit, removing its impurities. It softens, then liquefies. Once re-solidified, the resulting coke is a porous, carbon-heavy material. And that was the article, "Several Injured in Pennsylvania Steel Plant Explosion." Well, at 45 minutes past the hour, let's take a look at some other articles from around the nation, and maybe a few from the world. This first one is kind of related to one of our cover stories. This is an article entitled, "Trial Kicks Off Over Use of Military in Policing," written by Dietrich Nauth and Jack Queen from the Reuters News Group. A landmark trial kicked off on August 11th. Over the Trump administration's use of National Guard troops to support its deportation efforts and quell protest in Los Angeles, in a legal challenge highlighting the president's break from long-standing norms against deploying soldiers on American streets. The three-day, non-jury trial before U.S. District Judge Charles Breyer in San Francisco will determine if the government violated a 19th-century law that bars the military from civil law enforcement when it deployed troops to Los Angeles in June. Los Angeles suffered days of unrest and protest sparked by mass immigration raids at places where people gather to find work, like Home Depot stores or a garment factory and a warehouse. The administration denies troops were used in civil law enforcement and plans to show they were protecting federal property and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents. Many of the troops have been withdrawn, but California's Attorney General, Rob Bonta, said on August 11th that 300 National Guard members are still going on immigration raids and restricting civilian movements in the state. Bonta said in a statement, quote, "The federal government deployed military troops to the streets of Los Angeles for the purposes of political theater and public intimidation. This dangerous move has no precedent in American history," unquote. Now, a ruling against the government could restrict those troops' activities and constrain President Donald Trump if he tries to deploy troops to police American cities in the future. The trial before Breyer will have limited impact, however, on the Trump administration's plans to deploy hundreds of National Guard troops to Washington, D.C. Unlike in California and every other state, where the governor typically decides when to activate Guard troops, the president directly controls the National Guard in Washington. California and its governor, Gavin Newsom, have asked Judge Breyer to prohibit the troops from directly participating in domestic law enforcement activities. California and Newsom say the National Guard is accompanying ICE agents on raids and assisting in arrest, which is in violation of the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 and other laws that forbid the U.S. military from taking part in civilian law enforcement. Trump ordered 700 Marines and 4,000 National Guard troops to Los Angeles in June against Newsom's wishes. Trump's decision to send troops into Los Angeles prompted a national debate about the use of the military on U.S. soil and inflamed political tension in the country's second most populous city. California sued the Trump administration over the troop deployment, arguing that it violates federal law and state sovereignty. A U.S. appeals court has allowed Trump to retain control of California's National Guard during the legal challenge. California's lawsuit ultimately seeks a ruling that would return its National Guard troops to state control and a declaration that Trump's action was illegal. And that's "Trial Kicks Off Over Use of Military in Policing." Our next article is entitled, "Eli Lilly's Weight Loss Pill Shows Promise in Trial," by Alyssa Guffey for the Indianapolis Star out of Indianapolis. Eli Lilly is one step closer to bringing an oral weight loss medicine to the obesity drug market, company officials announced on August 7th. In a clinical trial, the company's weight loss pill led to a nearly 12% weight loss at 72 weeks for participants who took the highest dose of the medicine. The trial that included more than 3,000 people is one of two late-stage trials that the drug must pass before Lilly can submit the pill for federal approval, which CEO David Ricks said on August 7th that he expects the company to do by the end of the year. Lilly reported that participants lost an average of 27 pounds on the once-daily pill, named Orforglipron, or something like that, compared to other GLP-1 injectable medicines like Zepbound and Mounjaro. The safety of the pill was also equivalent to other GLP-1s. For Lilly, the clinical results are a positive sign for its oral weight loss pill that the company hopes will be as successful as the injectable drugs. But in the eyes of some investors and doctors, the clinical results fell short. Investors were hoping for results closer to 15% weight loss and expressed concern about the number of people who dropped out of the trial. Around 12% of the people left the trial due to side effects or personal reasons. Ricks cautioned that people can quit a trial for a number of reasons and said the results of the pill matched Lilly's expectations for the medicine. Other medicines in the same drug class are shown to result in as much as 20% in weight loss. Now, Lilly's obesity pill works similarly to Zepbound, an injectable offered by Lilly, by targeting gut hormones to promote weight loss. The Indianapolis drug maker is hoping to expand access to weight loss drugs by offering an oral medication. European rival Novo Nordisk, the company behind the injectable drug Wegovy, is also developing an obesity pill. But Lilly is considered to be in the lead to bring an oral medication to market. By this time next year, Lilly could be producing the drug, Rick said. Lilly reported 38% year-over-year revenue growth on August 7th, raising the company's outlook for 2025 amid what has been a roller coaster year so far. A few months ago, Ricks strongly cautioned President Donald Trump about the adverse effects retaliatory tariffs in the area of pharmaceuticals could have on U.S. drug manufacturers who export popular medicines and the rest of the industry. Lilly operates large manufacturing hubs in Europe and could face higher prices to bring their own drugs back to the United States. To increase domestic production, Lilly is building four new manufacturing facilities in the United States through a $27 billion investment. Lilly hopes the facilities will make medicine for patients within the next 5 years. Investors did not ask about tariffs on the August 7th earnings call, rather focusing on how Lilly plans to approach drug reform pricing. Trump has instructed 17 drug companies, which includes Lilly, to take steps to address what he calls abusive drug pricing practices by September 29th. Ricks told investors Lilly is in talks with the administration to bring down drug prices for the average American. And that's Eli Lilly's weight loss pill shows promise in trial. Our next article is about one of the wildfires burning here in the United States. Colorado prison evacuated amid growing Lee fire. Colorado prison was evacuated due to a fast-growing wildfire that is already one of the largest in state history. The ongoing spread of the Lee fire, L-E-E, Lee fire in western Colorado forced the relocation of 179 incarcerated individuals at the Rifle Correctional Center, and they were moved to the Buena Vista Correctional Complex on August 9th, according to a Colorado Department of Corrections news release. Now, while no injuries were reported at the prison, which is about 70 miles northeast of Grand Junction, Colorado, all of the inmates were moved outside the fire area, quote, out of an abundance of caution, unquote. The Lee Fire, which began on August 2nd, has burned more than 106,000 acres, according to an update on IncinaWeb, a government website that monitors wildfires. The blaze has reached 6% containment. The blaze is nearing the fifth largest by acreage in state history, which was the 2018 Spring Creek Fire that burned over 108,000 acres. Several western states, including Colorado, are battling large wildfires. In California's largest fire of 2025, over 118,000 acres are estimated to have burned in the Gifford Fire, and it's only 33% contained. The U.S. Forest Service has faced criticism from current and former employees who say federal workforce reductions under the Trump administration have left fire teams understaffed as the county grapples with decade-high wildfire numbers this year. National and local Forest Service officials say, however, the forest is ready for what is expected to be a worse-than-average fire year in California and the Pacific Northwest and the Northern Rockies, according to the National Interagency Fire Center forecast. However, more than a dozen active and retired U.S. Forest Service employees told Reuters that the agency is struggling to fill critical roles after approximately 5,000 employees quit in the past 5 months. That's roughly 15% of its workforce. The crew leader on an Oregon blaze said her team went hungry for several days, ran short of medical supplies, and had to scrounge for chainsaw fuel after support staff quit the agency during two rounds of fork-in-the-road buyouts. And that was a part of the article, California Prison Evacuated Amid Growing Lee Fire. We're at the end of our time together, so I'm going to have to say goodbye. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the first hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Tuesday, August 12th, 2025. Have a great day. Bye-bye.